The headlines: the U.S. launches a drone strike against what it calls a Daesh planner in Afghanistan's Nangarhar province and issues a fresh security warning. Iran's top diplomat says Tehran welcomes any Iraqi initiative which gets regional countries on board as he heads to Baghdad to attend a regional summit. And Lebanon's prime minister-designate dismisses criticisms of Beirut's fuel deals with Iran, saying that he opposes anything that would harm his country's interests. Well, welcome to our studio here in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. The U.S. military says it has carried out a drone strike against a Daesh planner in eastern Afghanistan. The military said the strike took place in Nangarhar province. Said initial indications are that the target was killed. The drone strike took place early on Saturday, 2 days after a bomb attack hit Kabul airport. The attack was claimed by the Daesh terror group. According to U.S. media, it killed at least 180 people, including 13 U.S. service members. The attack was the deadliest for American forces in over a decade. It took place as Afghans and foreign nationals were awaiting evacuation 2 weeks after the Taliban takeover of Kabul. Meanwhile, the U.S. Embassy in the Afghan capital Kabul has issued a fresh warning for Americans to avoid traveling to the city's airport, citing security threats. U.S. citizens have also been asked to leave the surrounding areas of the airport immediately. The warning came hours after the Pentagon said the evacuation process continued to face, quote, specific, credible threats. That followed Thursday's deadly attack outside of Kabul airport. The attack hampered the evacuation process of foreign nationals and forces ahead of the August 31st deadline. However, Western officials have said the evacuation of civilians is underway at a very fast pace to meet the deadline. More than 5,000 people remain inside the airport awaiting evacuation, while some Western countries, including Spain and France, have already ended their operations. Let's get more from our correspondent, Amin Alami, who joins us. Amin, at this point, tell us the situation in the airport overall.
Well, the situation in the airport is chaotic so far, and thousands of people are still stationed very close to Kabul International Airport, despite the U.S. embassy, U.S. officials and U.K. officials had already warned of possible terrorist attacks by Daesh members in Kabul International Airport. However, the Pentagon also said that it's going to continue the evacuation process in order to fully evacuate all of U.S. citizens and those who have worked with them over the past 20 years. In the meantime, some other countries have insisted that the evacuation process has been ended, and they are not willing to continue such a process from Kabul International Airport. But I personally went to Kabul International Airport and talked to many people around that area. But I struggled to get into the airport, but both the Taliban and Afghan forces were Afghan forces and American troops who are stationed there and currently they are deployed there did not allow me to get into the airport and talk to those who were there. However, the Taliban blamed the U.S. for failing to protect civilians who had gathered close to the eastern entrance gate of Kabul International Airport. And Zabihullah Mujahid said, who is the spokesperson of Taliban, said that it was the failure of U.S. military forces that Daesh terrorists made their way to the entrance gate of Kabul International Airport and blown up themselves. As a result, over 170 people were killed, including 13 American soldiers. But let's not forget that this incident, twin blasts in Kabul that happened on Thursday night, brought vast condemnations inside and abroad. For instance, I can point out to the census of some political leaders of Afghanistan, for example, Hamid Karzai, who was the former Afghan president, Hashmat Ghani Ahmadzai, who is the brother of former Afghan president Ashraf Ghani, as well as Gulbuddin Hikmatyar. All of them have condemned those attacks and named them as a brutal attack against the humanity and against the civilians who have decided to leave their country due to several security threats, mainly due to the rise and due to the emergent revival of Daesh terrorist group here in Afghanistan. In the meantime, the Pentagon also carried out an airstrike on Jalalabad, the capital city of Eastern Nangarhar province of Afghanistan. According to official sources there, this recent airstrike was conducted by a U.S. drone, and it has hit an area inside Police District 7 of Jalalabad city in eastern Afghanistan. As a result, according to sources in Nangarhar province, as well as according to the Pentagon, the planner of Thursday twin blasts on Kabul International Airport was killed as a result of this attack. However, the people of Afghanistan, I mean those who are currently facing a chaotic situation here in the Afghan capital Kabul, and especially around the Kabul International Airport, seem to have lost their hope regarding to the fate of their country, because they were not optimistic about the behavior of Taliban, at least since 1 week ago. But given the Taliban struggle to be friendly with the people of Afghanistan, we are witnessing that some are trying to make agreements with, be happy with the such situation, live under such circumstances here. But most of the those who have either worked with foreigners or they have worked in non-governmental organizations or many other areas, excluding war fronts, are worried. They are leaving their country in big numbers. For instance, I can point out to the withdrawal of at least 56 Afghan journalists over the past 1 month from Afghanistan due to expected terrorist attacks or expected prosecutions by the Taliban. However, there are also some reports I personally heard that armed men who have named themselves as the Taliban have entered many houses close to our residential area, and they searched the houses and they asked for specific individuals. But I talked to the Taliban officials as well. They say that we are not after launching such plans or programs. We are not after taking revenge from anybody, even those, even from those who had who has worked as a governmental military, as a government military employee. But in the meantime, Taliban say that we are launching a big investigation to find out more about those incidents, because Zabihullah Mujahid said that there are some other secret hands that are after damaging the face of the Taliban worldwide. But the people of Afghanistan also call not only on the Taliban, on the so-called resistance front in northern Afghanistan, but on regional and international players to hear their voices, because they say that this is not either the Taliban or any other internal player in Afghanistan who takes the final decision about the fate of this country.
Okay, you talked about how you believe that the planner, or that you got information that the planner was actually killed. Can you tell us more about that? How did that happen, and how did they know that that person was the one who was responsible or was involved in the bomb attack in Kabul airport?
This is according to the Pentagon sources. According to Pentagon, the planner of this attack, who was a key commander of Daesh terrorist group and was stationed in Eastern Nangarhar province of Afghanistan, was killed by a U.S. unmanned airstrike. The Taliban confirmed the incident, saying that such an attack has happened inside the city of Jalalabad, but they have refused to comment regarding to the outcome of this recent U.S. airstrike in Jalalabad, the capital city of Nangarhar, in eastern Afghanistan. In the meantime, the Taliban themselves declared that we have captured three attackers who have planned to launch another deadly blast on Kabul International Airport on Saturday. According to Taliban sources, investigations are underway and they will decide soon about the fate of these three Daesh terrorists.
Thank you so much for that. Amin Alami there from Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Many thanks, Amin. On to Iraq, Iran's foreign minister says Tehran welcomes any Iraqi initiative which gets some regional countries on board. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comment before leaving for the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, to attend a summit there. The event is part of Iraq's efforts to restore its role and status in the region. Iraq says the summit is aimed at easing tensions in the region, boosting economic cooperation, and resolving differences between neighboring countries. Among the dignitaries attending the summit is the French President Emmanuel Macron, who arrived in Baghdad earlier today. Upon arrival, Macron held a joint press conference with the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. France is the co-organizer of the Baghdad summit. Meanwhile, reports coming out of Iraq suggest that a U.S. military base in the south of the Arab country has come under a rocket attack. Local media have reported explosions in the town of Safwan in Basra province. Security sources said the blasts were caused by three rockets fired at a U.S. base near the border with Kuwait. The source said one rocket flew over the base and landed inside Kuwait. That, however, has been denied by Kuwait's military. There's been no report of possible casualties or damage. No group has claimed responsibility. The U.S. had previously blamed similar strikes on Iraqi resistance groups, a charge denied by them. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the U.N. has warned against any Israeli adventurism against Tehran. In a letter to the U.N. Security Council, Zahra Ershadi referred to Israel's recent threats about the possibility of an attack on Iran. She noted that the threats constitute a gross violation of international rights and the U.N. Charter and must not be tolerated by the international community. On Wednesday, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, accused Iran of seeking a nuclear weapon. He said military action should be considered as a plan B to prevent Tehran from accessing a warhead. Iran has on numerous occasions said it does not want war, but will give a crushing response to any aggression.
The Israeli regime is a sworn enemy of regional power, Iran, and it makes no secret of its animosity towards the Islamic Republic, which is leading a regional front against the occupying force. The regime has assassinated several top Iranian nuclear scientists in Iran and is widely believed to have carried out sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities, which operate under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Israel has recently escalated its anti-Iran rhetoric. This week, the regime renewed military threats against the Islamic Republic. The Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, issued a new threat against Iran's nuclear facilities. Gantz said Israel has the means to act alone and would not hesitate to strike Iran. He made the threat after once again accusing Tehran of orchestrating a recent drone attack on an Israeli-linked oil tanker last month. The Mercer Street was sailing in the sea off Oman on July 29th when it was struck. Iran has denied any involvement in that attack, but Tel Aviv is apparently using the naval incident as a pretext to rally its regional and Western allies against Iran. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who is currently in the United States, is also trying to persuade the Americans to avoid diplomacy with Iran. The Israeli premier insisted that clandestine operations against Iran's nuclear program would not stop.
It's meant to create tension, and it is meant to try to push the Biden administration into disavowing negotiations with Iran. I'm quite sure that those negotiations will go on, even if, discreetly, even if there is a public avowal to support Israeli security.
Tensions between Iran and Israel are many decades old. Tough exchanges have been ongoing between the two sides for a very long time, but right now they seem even harsher. Israel's threats of military action against the Islamic Republic have not gone unanswered.
Bennett seems to be on a mission in the U.S., pushing U.S. President Joe Biden to get tougher on Iran. Soon after arrival in the U.S., Bennett doubled down on his threats against Iran. Will that affect America's stance? The U.S. president has already refused to lift any of the sanctions that his predecessor imposed on Iran after unilaterally leaving the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. Biden was a vociferous critic of Donald Trump's Iran policy, But after several months into his presidency, he is still refusing to change America's course. Biden's stance has seriously undermined the prospect of a return to the 2015 nuclear deal, as Iran insists that the U.S. sanctions must be removed before the deal is restored. Meanwhile, the Iranians have made it clear that any attack on Iran would be met with ultimate force. Just recently, the commander-in-chief of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps warned that a mistake on the part of the regime would lead to its collapse. Major General Hossein Salami said the stage has been set for Israel's collapse in any future war.
It would defend itself with all of the military might it can muster. And in the case of Iran, that's quite a bit. And that is, again, why I say it is obvious to me, and it should be obvious to most observers, that the United States does not want to get drawn into that type of a situation. I do believe that Israel fully understands that any attack against Iran would be a serious blowback to itself.
The regime could carry out more covert operations against the Iranians, further raising regional tensions. But if that happens and things spiral out of control, the regime has to be held responsible for instability in the region and beyond.
And that is for Walt Disney.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight. For Saudis who participated in the 2018 killing of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi received paramilitary training in the United States the previous year under a contract approved by the U.S. State Department, according to documents and people familiar with the arrangement. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Mark Mazzetti, Julian Barnes, and Michael LaForgia. The piece is titled, Saudi Operatives Who Killed Khashoggi Received Paramilitary Training in United States. Saudi nationals who participated in the 2018 killing of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi received paramilitary training in the United States the previous year under a contract approved by the U.S. State Department, according to documents and people familiar with the arrangement. The instruction occurred as the secret unit responsible for Mr. Khashoggi's killing was beginning an extensive campaign of kidnapping, detention, and torture of Saudi citizens, ordered by Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, to crush dissent inside the kingdom. The training was provided by the Arkansas-based security company Tier 1 Group, which is owned by the private equity firm Cerberus Capital Management. The company says the training, including safe marksmanship and countering an attack, was defensive in nature and devised to better protect Saudi leaders. One person familiar with the training said it also included work in surveillance and close quarters battle. There is no evidence that the American officials who provided the training or Tier 1 group executives knew that the Saudis were involved in the crackdown inside Saudi Arabia. But the fact that the government approved high-level military training for operatives who went to carry out the grisly killing of a journalist shows how intensely intertwined the United States has become with an autocratic nation, even as its agents committed horrific human rights abuses. It also underscores the perils of military partnerships with repressive governments and demonstrates how little oversight exists for those forces after they return home. Such issues are likely to continue as American private military contractors increasingly look to foreign clients to shore up their business as the United States scales back overseas deployments after two decades of war. The U.S. State Department initially granted a license for the paramilitary training of the Saudi Royal Guard to Tier 1 Group, starting in 2014, during the Obama administration. The training continued during at least the first year of former President Donald J. Trump's term in office. Louis Bremer, a senior executive of Cerberus Capital Management, Tier 1 Group's parent company, confirmed his company's role in the training last year in written answers to questions from lawmakers as part of his nomination for a top Pentagon job during the Donald Trump administration. The administration does not appear to have sent the document to Congress before withdrawing Mr. Bremer's nomination. Lawmakers never received answers to their questions. In the document, which Louis Bremer provided to the New York Times, he said that four members of the Khashoggi kill team had received Tier 1 group training in 2017, and two of them had participated in a previous iteration of the training, which went from October of 2014 until January of 2015. The training provided was unrelated to their subsequent heinous acts, Louis Bremer said in his responses. He said that a March 2019 review by Tier 1 Group uncovered no wrongdoing by the company and confirmed that the established curriculum training was unrelated to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Mr. Louis Bremer said that the State Department, in collaboration with other U.S. departments and agencies, is responsible for vetting the foreign forces trained on U.S. soil. All foreign personnel trained by the Tier 1 group are cleared by the U.S. government for entry into the United States before commencement of their training. In a statement, Louis Bremer said that the training was protective in nature and that the company conducted no further training of Saudis after December of 2017. The Tier 1 group management, the board, and I stand firmly with the U.S. government, the American people, and the international community in condemning the horrific murder of Jamal Khashoggi, he said. A 2019 column by David Ignatius of Washington Post first reported that members of the Khashoggi kill team had received training in the United States. David Ignatius wrote that the CIA had cautioned other government agencies that some special operations training may have been conducted by Tier 1 group under a U.S. State Department license. The issue was central to Mr. Luis Bremer's contentious confirmation hearing and the written questions from senators asking him what role, if any, Tier 1 group had in training Saudi nationals who had participated in the Jamal Khashoggi operation. A State Department spokesman declined to confirm whether it awarded licenses to Tier 1 group for the Saudi training. This administration insists on responsible use of U.S. origin defense equipment and training by our allies and partners, and considers appropriate responses if violations occur, said the spokesman Ned Price. Saudi Arabia faces significant threats to its territory, and we are committed to working together to help Riyadh strengthen its defenses. Meanwhile, a spokesman for the Saudi embassy in Washington did not comment. Former President Donald Trump weighed installing the head of Cerberus Capital Management, Steven Feinberg, in a top intelligence post last year, but the appointment was never made. While the Trump administration had appointed Mr. Feinberg to lead the president's intelligence advisory board in 2018, questions emerged about potential conflicts of interest. Cerberus Capital Management formerly owned the military contractor DynCorp, which among other things provides intelligence advice to the United States and other clients. It is unclear which members of the Khashoggi kill team participated in the Tier 1 group training. Seven members of the team belong to an elite unit charged with protecting the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, according to an American intelligence report about the assassination declassified in February. The role of operatives from the so-called Rapid Intervention Force in the Khashoggi killing helped bolster the American intelligence case that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the operation. Members of the Rapid Intervention Force would not have participated in the killing without his consent, according to the report. The group exists to defend the Saudi Crown Prince and answers only to him, the document said. Members of the team that killed Jamal Khashoggi were involved in at least a dozen operations starting in 2017, according to officials who have read declassified intelligence reports about the campaign. Mr. Khashoggi, a columnist for the Washington Post, was killed inside the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul in October of 2018. His body was dismembered using a bone saw. The assassination brought widespread condemnation of the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who tried to deny any knowledge of the operation. Eight defendants were sentenced to up to 2 decades in prison last year, but human rights advocates criticized the punishments as aimed at lower-level agents while sparing their leaders. The CIA concluded that the Saudi Crown Prince directed the operation, but Donald Trump said the evidence was inconclusive and that America's diplomatic and economic relationship with Saudi Arabia took priority. After President Joe Biden took office and debated the issue with his advisors before the release of the declassified intelligence report, his administration announced sanctions on Saudi citizens involved in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, including members of the elite unit who protect the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. but President Joe Biden chose not to directly punish the Saudi crown prince. The earlier iteration of the training, which took place during the Obama administration, occurred before Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman consolidated his power in the kingdom. His predecessor as Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef was a close ally of the United States and in particular of John O. Brennan, who served as CIA Director General under President Barack Obama. Prince Mohammed bin Nayef was the Saudi counterterrorism chief and collaborated closely with the Obama administration officials. In 2017, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman pushed Prince Mohammed bin Nayef from power and executed a broader campaign to wrest power from his rivals, including a notorious episode of imprisoning Saudi royals and businessmen at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh. The Trump administration considered him a valuable partner in the Middle East, and Prince Mohammed bin Salman developed a close relationship with Jared Kushner, the former president's son-in-law who served as a senior advisor to Donald Trump. Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the son of King Salman, is the next in line to the Saudi throne. Prince Mohammed bin Nayef remains under house arrest in Saudi Arabia. The Tier 1 group website lists numerous American special operations and intelligence units as clients, along with specialty units that do not require recognition. It said it also trains OGA special operator teams, one pseudonym for CIA paramilitary units, as well as international allied forces. Under federal rules that restrict foreign sales of American arms and military expertise, Tier 1 group was required to apply for licenses to train the foreign operatives. Those license applications were examined by State Department officials who were processing tens of thousands of licenses per year, and they were approved. The approval would have allowed members of the Saudi Royal Guard to enter the United States on visas processed by the American Embassy in Riyadh. The path is similar to the one followed by Second Lieutenant Mohammed Al-Shamrani, a Royal Saudi Air Force officer who opened fire in 2019 at a naval air station in Pensacola, Florida, where he was receiving military flight training. That attack killed at least 3 people and wounded 8 others.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of internet.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Russia says there will be consequences if Britain violates its territorial waters again. The Russian ambassador to the UK has said that his country would make it more difficult for British military vessels to enter its waters next time because, quote, this is not the first time a British warship has done this. Andrei Kellen was referring to a June intrusion by the British Navy destroyer HMS Defender as it sailed into Russia's territorial waters near Crimea in the Black Sea. Well, the Russian Defense Ministry said at the time that it had fired warning shots at the vessel off the coast of the Crimean Peninsula. Moscow also slammed Britain for violating international law and denounced the move as a dangerous and provocative one. Well, the UK, however, claimed the ship was in a commonly used transit route in accordance with international law. Now, to get further insight on the issue, we're joined by political analyst John Bosnich, who's with us from Belgrade, and also joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have writer and political analyst John White, who's with us from Edinburgh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Bosnich in Belgrade. Russia has issued a warning to the UK. You heard the comments saying that it'll be difficult now for British warships to pass through the disputed Black Sea if they choose to do so in the future. What do you make of the comments?
Well, I think this is a standard statement by a sovereign country that its territorial waters are inviolate, and that England does not have the right legally or practically to pass through Russian territorial waters without Russian permission. I think that Russia is smart to give the warning in advance so that if there are any complications, if anything does develop in this case, that they can simply say that you were warned and we have taken actions in keeping with our sovereign rights.
John White, the Russian ambassador to the UK, Andrei Kellen, said that it would be much harder for a UK military vessel to enter Russia's territorial waters without notice next time. Now, if we go back to when the incident happened, Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov was quoted as saying, what can we do? We can appeal to common sense, demand respect for international law. If this does not help, we can bomb not only in the direction but also on target if our colleagues do not understand. Those were some heavy words back then. What do you think about this new warning coupled with the comments that were made by the Russians back in June?
Well, it's very simple. Moscow has had enough of these repeated provocations on the part of a fading appeal hegemon, the UK. And it's very clear that in the context of Brexit, London is determined to try and prove its worth to Washington with these increasingly bellicose acts towards Russia, and it's clear that the cynical attempt to cultivate and promote enemies abroad is done with the objective of it of distracting from escalating and deepening injustices at home. Britain is trying to remain relevant in this the Brexit landscape, and it's using Russia as a flogging horse in an attempt to do so. But the Russians have had enough, rightly so, and they're drawing a red line. And it's high time this was done. The UK has been able to pose as a major power on the world stage under the umbrella of US hegemony. And the Russians understand this. And in Moscow, there is cold contempt for the UK in this regard. So this is a very much needed red line on the part of the Russians. They've been very restrained hitherto when it comes to these repeated provocations by the UK. And they've simply had enough. And I think that London would be well served to heed this warning, because when you poke the bear will roar at some point.
John Bosnich, as our guest in Edinburgh mentioned, Russians apparently have had enough. There was talk of this not being the first time when tensions were high between Kiev and Moscow. If you recall, the UK sent a Royal Navy ship to the Black Sea port of Odessa in a show of support for Ukraine back in 2018. It's worth saying that this is not without precedent, was it?
No, there's definitely there's definitely a building level of tension here, and I think that England is going to start getting back a little bit of what it's been giving out around the world for hundreds of years. Other countries which were the target of English colonial activity, occupation, unjustified wars of aggression, are now asserting their territorial limits. And this is particularly bothersome for England because England has been able to basically operate a pirate navy around the world, running the, as they did in the old days. In the daytime, they have the Union Jack, and at the nighttime, or when there's nobody watching, they run up the Jolly Roger. The same ship, the same crew, just their uniforms not so visible. Now, we have to put this in context here. England is simultaneously threatening both Russia and China with its so-called freedom of the seas approach. Now, freedom of the seas is a concept which is accepted internationally, which is the right to travel from two legitimate destinations across open seas. There is no need for the English fleet to be in the Black Sea, except if it's projecting the outdated power of the English Empire. England has no territory in the area. England is, of course, engaged in provocations in Ukraine, where it has special forces trying to disrupt the region and push the ethnic Russians out of Donbass. But as far as it goes for the sea lanes, the English Navy has no business being there, except perhaps as an observer of confirmed international trade. When we couple this with the increasing levels of provocation that England is posing to China, especially in the Taiwan Straits and in the South China Sea, we are looking at a situation in which the so-called invincible English fleet could be facing two military confrontations at the same time. And that is a recipe for disaster. What we're looking at here effectively for the English fleet is what happened to the French army at Bien Bien Phu. Outnumbered, surrounded, and destroyed. If that happens, that will be the single biggest change in international relations in more than 300 years.
John White, would you like to add anything to that?
No, that's a very eloquent analysis, and I agree wholeheartedly with every word and every particular. We have to bring things to the present. This was in June. We're now looking at the debacle in Afghanistan, where the US under Joe Biden didn't even consult with the UK with regards to its withdrawal, its precipitous withdrawal, and that shows you what Biden thinks of this special relationship. The special relationship, so-called, only ever existed in the hearts and minds of UK political underpins and the UK political establishment. For the US and Washington, UK was always seen as a proxy, not an ally, and this is being played out in Afghanistan as we speak. I think the UK is in a crisis. I think it's headed for perdition. I think it's headed for ruination. I think it's headed for its eventual breakup. And one of the most wonderful and poetic historical ironies is that Brexit, rather than bolstering UK power under the auspices of global Britain, as supporters of Brexit have maintained that Brexit has ushered in, is only ushered in the eventual breakup of the UK. And when that day comes, when Ireland becomes united, when Scotland becomes independent, a cry of freedom will ring out around the world, such as never been heard before.
Mr. John White, I'm going to stay with you. Would, in your opinion, would inciting conflict in the Black Sea be something that the U.S. and Britain are contemplating, given the heightened tensions between Moscow on one side, we've got the U.S., the U.K., also the EU, add them to the mix on the other. What kind of repercussions do you think would there be from any further standoffs in the Black Sea region?
It's over for the best. This happened in June. Afghanistan, the debacle, the scramble out of Central Asia changes everything and changes it utterly. This is a historic tipping point. It's a major signpost on the way to Western US-led hegemonic imperial decline. The West is in retreat. The West is no longer the dominant power, the dominant bloc. The West unipolar moment after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 is over. Everyone's looking to the East. The East has the solutions to the challenges of the 21st century. The West is over. And as I said earlier, it's a wonderful thing to see because of the carnage, the chaos, the instability, the mayhem wrought by US-led Western hegemony since the fall of the Soviet bloc.
And Mr. Bozich, I see you nodding there. Would you like to add anything to comments made by Mr. White?
Well, I have to say it's a pleasure to be commenting with a fellow analyst who shares every one of my views on the same subject. And we come from very different backgrounds, and we're looking at this from, I'm here in Serbia, in southeastern Europe, and I grew up in Canada, and I spent 20 years in Japan as a political analyst and advisor. And I can tell you that from all of the places that I've worked in, the signs are more than clear. The English, and I refer to it as England, I don't refer to it as the UK or Britain, it's ruled from London and it's an English ruling class. The English ruling class is now facing its potential last hurrah. And because they are worried, they are being aggressive. That's the first sign that a party is worried. You don't need to flex your muscles unless you're worried that the other party has bigger muscles than you do. And what we're seeing is the English Empire is falling back on its tried and true tactics of jingoism. By jingo, we have the means, and so on. And it will not work. The new weapons that have been displayed publicly by President Putin of Russia, and which have been quickly adopted and supported by China, are so far advanced that the English Navy is like a dugout canoe facing a laser weapon from outer space. This would be such an unequal conflict that I could see several principal ships being sunk with all hands lost in a matter of days. England needs some new advisors and they need some new thinking. This is a multilateral world today. It is no longer somebody calling the shots in London or Washington.
Mr. Bozich, I'm going to stay with you for this one. How does all of this, you know, when there are provocations in areas such as the Black Sea, when you add Russia to the mix, there is always going to be ripple effects near and far. How does all of this, the Black Sea incident, the Western troop buildup in Ukraine, in addition to NATO's eastward expansion, how does this play into the rivalry between Russia and NATO? Russia has already made it clear that NATO membership for Ukraine would be a red line for Moscow at this point.
NATO membership for Ukraine would be insane. NATO membership, first of all, under the rules of NATO, Ukraine cannot join NATO and NATO cannot accept Ukraine. Because one of the fundamental requirements of the acceptance of a state as a NATO member is that that state has control over its full and entire territory and its full and entire external border. As we know, the regime in Kiev, which was placed in power by the neocons in Washington, who staged an illegal coup, that regime in Kiev does not rule the country of Ukraine. It rules just as far as its official army and its neo-Nazi war groups can hold by the barrel of a gun. And that does not include Donbass, that does not include the former Ukrainian territory of Crimea. There is nothing on this earth short of nuclear war that could affect the status of Crimea. And even in the case of nuclear war, Crimea would remain a part of Russia. So that story is already a finished, printed, closed book. If England attempts at this time to pressure China, it will be bringing even more disaster upon itself because it will be facing, as I mentioned earlier, a two-front war, which it is 100% certain to lose. And in the meantime, while England continues to do its saber rattling from its leaky ships offshore, there could very well be a visit by Russian warships up the Thames River or around the territorial waters of England. And in that case, it would be checkmate, and England wouldn't even have enough time to knock over its own king.
John White, let's look at the issue of Crimea and the whole sovereignty issue from a different vantage point. Russia annexed the Crimean Peninsula following a referendum back in 2014, so it considers areas around its coast to be Russian waters. Western countries, they deem Crimea to still be part of Ukraine. They reject Russia's claim to the seas around it. Sergei Ryabkov said Washington and London are sowing strife by refusing to accept that Crimea is part of Russia. Now, there's clear hypocrisy again here by the likes of the United States. For example, they can accept illegal annexations and occupation by their allies, the Israelis, but when it's not in their own interest, they'll oppose it.
First of all, I must respectfully disagree with your terminology. Russia did not annex Crimea. Crimea was liberated by Russia via a legal democratic referendum in the wake of an unconstitutional coup that deposed the last all-Ukraine constitutional government under Viktor Yanukovych in 2014. The vast majority of people living in Crimea are Russian speakers or Russian ethnics. Ethnic Russians, sorry. And so Russia, as I say, liberated and saved Crimea from a fascistic takeover from Kiev. And by the way, avoided huge bloodshed when this coup government in Kiev attempted to extend its writ to parts of Crimea that did not accept this coup that took place in Kiev. So this was a democratic referendum, more democratic, by the way, than the referendum that seceded Kosovo from Serbia in 2009. So we have to get the terminology correct. But the UK and the West in general has never accepted this demarche when it comes to Crimea. Crimea is historically Russian, part of Mother Russia, and it's gone back to Mother Russia. And the vast majority of Crimeans are happy. There are no patrolling gunmen in the streets. There are no Crimeans in jail because they refuse to accept Russia's writ. The vast majority are very happy to be in the lap of Mother Russia in the wake of this unconstitutional coup that took place in Kiev at the start of 2014. But the West refuses to accept this for its own geopolitical and geostrategic reasons. That's the only reason. It's nothing to do with legality. It's everything to do with geopolitics and the geostrategic objectives when it comes to trying to impose a cordon sanitaire around Russia.
And Mr. Bozic, your final thoughts on the same issue as well while you wrap up the program tonight.
Well, you know, I'm glad that the so-called referendum in Kosovo was mentioned because I'm here right in the region. The so-called referendum in Kosovo was held after all of the minority groups, the local minority groups, the Serbs were a minority in the province, were driven out at pain of death. And then they held a referendum. The referendum that was held in Crimea was held without the departure of any of the residents of Crimea. So it was a representative referendum. And it was such an overwhelming referendum that it was hard to find anybody who voted against rejoining Russia. And this is the key word here, rejoining Russia. Because one of the things that very few people mention is that Crimea was an integral part of Russia for many, many, many years, in fact, hundreds of years. And Crimea only became a part of Ukraine out of a kind of act of undemocratic behavior by a previous Soviet dictator who transferred it to Ukraine as a present without a referendum, without any due process. And at the time, in the 1950s, when that was done, the State Department of the United States and the Foreign Ministry of England declared it to be an unlawful and illegal act. So what that means is both the United States and England know that the presence of Crimea in Ukraine was an unlawful and illegal status, which Russia corrected following England and America's own advice. History is a stubborn thing. and Americans don't study it at all.
All right, gentlemen, we're going to leave it there. We're fresh out of time for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, political analyst John Bosnich, joining us from Belgrade. Also, thanks to writer and political analyst John White, joining us from Edinburgh. And also, special thanks to you all for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو ذا الرحمن.
Allah
هو ذا المنان.
لا إله إلا الله.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs. Before starting our show, I'd like to offer my condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the third Imam of the Shia school of thought, and the great tragedy of Karbala and his loyal companions. The topic that we are, inshallah, discussing here would be related to somehow to the doubts and misconceptions which are raised and posed against the important revolution of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. For that, we have invited Islamic researcher Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools to help us with the answers to the questions that we shall pose here. Before starting this discussion, I'd like to say salam to Sheikh and welcome him to the show. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thanks again for accepting the invitation. The question of the day that we want to ask it in this show from respected guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools, is a famous and old doubt that has been asked in the course of history, that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was martyred by his awaiters, those who have invited him. There is a version of history that says that Imam alayhi salam was martyred by his followers, was by his Shias, those who have invited him to come back, to come to Kufa to help us and to lead us. We are lacking an Islamic, a pure Islamic leader. Whenever I face such a question and doubt, this reminds me of a famous word of Imam Ali alayhi salam, "Kalam haqqan yuradu bil batil." It's a true, actually, excerpt of the history, but they want to take